My name is Nathaniel Abdul-Khali. I was born and raised in St. Paul, Minnesota, about a half a mile away from where I live now on Rondo Avenue. And Rondo was a historic African-American community up until 1956, and we were displaced by the freeway at that time. And so my grandfather was one of the last houses on Rondo that was moved out, and he refused to move and had to be forced out of his home by law enforcement officials. It used to be called Rondo, now it's called Concordia. The African American community was about three or four blocks north and south of the freeway. And where the freeway lies today was Rondo and part of St. Anthony. 1956. That's when they started building the federal interstate highway across the country under President Eisenhower. And that community back then was a self-contained community. We had all the, every kind of business that you could think of. The families had long ties together. We had political, social, and economic, you know, power. And when the freeway came, it displaced over 600 families, never to come back together again. You know, it tore out our social engine, our economic engine, and our political engine to a certain extent. Well, I was about 12 or 13 years old, and growing up, you know, that was my home. I was raised by my grandparents until I was about 12 or 13 years old, and then I started living with my mother. I didn't know my father, so my grandmother and grandfather was the primary influence in my life at that time. And my grandfather was a evangelist preacher, and he was very, very religious, and my grandmother was one of the most faithful people that I've ever met in my life, and she was blind. And so, you know, I was raised under a very structured religious, you know, environment.
I was born in North Dakota, Fargo. I'm sorry my husband is in here, but I lost him, and I've forgotten the date that I lost him. But we were married many years, because I married when I was about 18, and I am 90 now. My birthday is December 23rd, and my husband was a sheep butcher. He worked at Island and Company, and he started out when he was young because he was born in the Depression like I was, and he was the only man in the family because the father had left home. They didn't get along, and so he went to work early and didn't finish his schooling. So he was about, I think, 16 when he came out of school. So he had to take care of his mother and helped to give her. She worked, but I mean, he was the main breadwinner. Because the reason I remember that so well is because we had to postpone our business, our wedding, because his salary went to, you know, to his mother. And so we got along through that period. But I did there go to high school, and then college was out of it, no money, yeah, depression. Well, I was raised, you know, in Christianity at the Presbyterian Church, and it was down on Lewis Street, I think. Oh, that was where the Welcome Hall was. Oh, my goodness. Let's see, where was the church? The church was on Central and McCubbin. When I got black in Minnesota, well, I would say the most thing you would think is, you know, naturally white people and black people. We were very separated, and I'd say, because there was such a difference, you know. And we lived next door to some Catholics, white people, and they were nice, you know, and we got along with them wonderfully. But then there was some up the street that we didn't get along with because they thought they were superior to us, you know. And so, and naturally, after getting into school and whatnot, we rather ignored them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's the way it was. As I said before, though, when we came into Islam and we started going to the meetings wherever they were, you know, and then we felt like human beings. Mm-hmm. Brother Joe used to come around, and that's when we first found out about Islam. He brought the papers. We were so glad and so proud to come into Islam.
And so these brothers would go through the predominantly African-American communities door to door selling Muhammad Speak newspaper, selling bean pies and selling fish, or they would stand on the corner, you know, getting the word out. Joe Kareem was, he used to be the, we didn't call them imams back then, we call them minister. Minister Joe Kareem and his wife. He was a minister in the Nation of Islam, and she was like, you know, the first lady. She was head of the women's MTG. You know, he was an interesting fella. He used to own a beauty shop and a beauty supply store, and then he had a grocery store. He ran a tight ship, and when the Nation of Islam, when Elijah Muhammad passed, they sent someone here from Chicago named Charles El Amin back in 1975. His son is now the imam of the masjid at Masjid An-Nur.
When Charles El Amin came to town, and then the transformation, for lack of a better word, sort of took place. Mm-hmm. And so we as a community sort of made the changes. Mm-hmm. So it was after the messenger died, that's how we got into Orthodox Islam. Okay. Do you remember? Do you remember when Charles and Arlene El Amin first came?
Yes.
Okay, and that's when it started.
How long? That's what I can't remember. How long I've been going to the masjid.
Well, this particular Masjid An-Nur, the foundation of Masjid An-Nur, started before 1975. Mm-hmm. So I would say at least 40, 50 years, going all the way back to the temple that used to, is the Nation of Islam temple that used to be on 4th and 38th, mm-hmm. in which we attended. So some of those same people used to be kids now.
Wow.
And have, you know, grown up. So I would say, in Sister Nisa's case, probably over 50 years.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't Masjid An-Nur back then, though, but I'm just saying.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've been in this Muslim community for a long time. You've seen a lot. What advice do you have to the up-and-coming Muslim
Americans? The up-and-coming Muslims? Well, just be hardworking and take care of your own business and treat people with respect. Mm-hmm. And that's all you have to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I joined the Marines, I ran across the autobiography of Malcolm X. That was one of the first, it was the first book that I've ever read. And so I read the book and I was impressed. I was impressed by where he started and the direction in which he headed and his final destination, you know, while he was here on earth. I felt that I was inspired by that, and it seemed like that the thing that it turned him around was Islam. Initially, the Nation of Islam teaching, and then after he went on the Hajj, you know, that changed his whole way of thinking, and he accepted Islam in his fullest form, in correct form. And so that started me to thinking. And then the Nation of Islam appealed to me. It appealed to mostly my emotions, not so much to my heart, but to my emotions, because it gave me a sense of self-worth. When Elijah Muhammad and Farad Muhammad told us that we were God and the white man was the devil. And I said, wow, I feel great, and put on a nice suit and everything, and I just felt like I could conquer the world. And in 1975, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad died, and his son, W.D. Muhammad, was good friends with Malcolm X. And they were considered, they were ostracized by the Nation of Islam. And so his son, W.D. Muhammad, took over. And the first thing he did, he started saying that we need to take the Quran down from, you know, from a shelf, because Elijah Muhammad taught us to wrap it up and put it up in a high place because you don't understand it. So we sat in chairs, you know, we didn't do Salat, Ramadan, and so forth. It was more of an empowering movement and self-help movement that saved thousands of lives, you know, probably, you know, including mine. But when the son, W.D. Muhammad, took over, he started transitioning towards Orthodox Islam. Wanted us to study the Quran, learn how to pray, understand the five pillars of Islam, to dispel this notion that we were God and the white man was the devil. And then I started learning about the Prophet Muhammad, may peace and blessings be upon him, the Prophet Muhammad. I mean, he was beautiful. You know, even before he came into the religion, he held himself in high esteem. He was well respected by people in his community. He was called El Amin, the trustworthy one. And so I started seeing Islam in his true form. And slowly but surely, and some old habits was hard to break, but slowly but surely started making that transformation. It's done some great things for my life, because I was a lost child. And other religions, I had looked at a little bit at the different ones and went to different churches, and none of them grabbed, you know, my heart, body, and soul like Islam. And so one who was in need of extreme discipline, it fit the bill, and I'm just thankful to Almighty God that he chose me to be part of this great religion. And I'm a student. I'm still learning. I'm 67 years old. Well, you know, when I started making the transition, I had a cousin who used to wear the hijab to school. She went to Central High School, and she was the only Muslim there. And she was totally isolated and ostracized, you know, for her years in school. My mom, when she found out that, actually my younger brother got involved in the Nation of Islam first, you know, then I got involved, and she questioned, you know, what are you guys doing? And she used to call us Moosies. She said, I don't know about them. And then when we crossed the line, when we came to her house and started going in her refrigerator removing the pork, and she said, if you so-and-sos don't get out of here, I'll kill you. So initially she had some reservations about it, but may God be pleased with her. She started seeing this transformation. She started seeing, you know, settling down, not bringing different people by her house, you know, young ladies and so forth, seeing my eyes clear, not smelling alcohol on my breath, seeing me be more responsible and so forth. And she accepted it, you know. As I started getting more and more involved, I would take her over to the temple, you know, as we called it back then, and then later on to the mosque for different events. You know, she never converted or anything, but, you know, she was well in acceptance of it. And many of my other family members, some who had sort of written me off and thought that maybe I had gone off on the deep end by getting involved in Islam. Why does he want to get involved with them Arabs, you know? And that was the other perception. Even though the Nation of Islam was doing its thing, that in the mind of many, that was separate from being part of Orthodox Islam. But for the most part, I lost some friendship, you know, with people that I grew up with, that we were close, because they stayed in their lane and continued to do what they were doing, and so we couldn't associate. We could see each other and speak and so forth. But for the most part, I think people have had people that knew me when and saw me, you know, make that transformation, you know, they accepted it.
You said you were the president of the local chapter of the NAACP?
Well, I started getting involved in community politics or community activism early on during my Nation of Islam days. I got involved in this community, you know, this area where we sit today used to be one of the worst areas in the city. And if you go back and look at newspaper archives about Dale and Selby and Hague Avenue and stuff, you'll see a lot of terrible things was going on. And so I had I got involved in community activism when a cousin of mine got killed at a sleazy joint up on Dale and Selby. That used to be one of the worst intersections in the city in the 70s, late 70s. I said, you know, something needed to be done about it. I wasn't sure what to do, but I was just, you know, feeling frustrated. And my wife said, well, you ought to stop complaining about it and do something about it. So I called the city about it, and they said, well, there's not much we can do. I ended up going around getting a petition. When they said, well, why don't you get a couple letters, I went around the neighborhood during my time off, knocking on people's doors, and some people saying, you know, man, you better look out. Them dudes will come after you. You're trying to close down their place and cut off their money. So anyway, got over 1,000 signatures, and that sort of put my name out there. We went down to the city council, wasn't able to get the ministers, any other organizations, but got a couple of survivors of victims who got killed down there, a couple ministers, and we went down there and told the city council they wouldn't tolerate this behavior in any other neighborhood besides this community, because it was predominantly black. And they ended up closing the place down, and the other places, you know, ended up getting closed down. And I started, you know, getting involved in making my neighborhood better. Even though my wife and I could have moved somewhere else, we decided to stay here. And so we fought the drug dealers, organized one of the first block clubs. Later on, I got on the fire department, and while I was at work one night, they attempted to firebomb my home here. You know, by the grace of Almighty God, my neighbor across the street has insomnia and had his window cracked open. It was in, I think, January or February. Heard these tires squeaking, you know, on the new snow and stuff, and looked out the window and saw the flames from the bottle burning, you know, the liquid spilled out on the porch. Luckily, it didn't hit the bay window there. It hit the rail and fell over and didn't break. And he called the fire department and then had his son come over and get my wife and kids out. They broke every window out of my vehicle, threw a large boulder through the front window. But, you know, by the grace of Almighty God, my family and I was spared. And the authorities wouldn't do that much about it at that time. I had to have some brothers from the masjid to come over and stay with my family at night while, you know, when I was on the fire department, because it was 24-hour shifts. And so after that, people started sort of, I was known back then as Nick Davis. And so people started just sort of coming to me for guidance and say, hey, Nick, we got a problem over here, and, you know, can you help us? And put this plan together and so forth. And, you know, I didn't have any formal training. I barely graduated from high school, never been to college, but, you know, been to trade school and so forth. But somehow, by the grace of Almighty God, he took that negative energy and sort of, I don't want to say fearlessness, but of spirit, to use it in a positive way. So we were able to organize, you know, the neighborhood and get rid of the drug dealers and close down places like that. And then people started asking me to, they have a planning council. I'd never been a chairman or a president of a board before, thought Robert's Rules of Order was some kind of game. You know, ended up being elected to president of the district planning council here in St. Paul. You know, for this area, there's about 17 of them. each district has its own planning council. And then ended up being elected to the president and chairman of some other boards, and eventually the NAACP, which is over 100 years old, an organization that I had a disdain, dislike for as a young man because I didn't think they were militant enough. I thought they were a bunch of sellout Uncle Toms and, you know, letting people beat on them and all that other stuff. But as I grew older, I understood that they were the real heroes in the struggle because of the sacrifice that they made and the faith that they had to make those sacrifices. And so some 15, 16 years ago, they came to me and asked me if I would, you know, run for the president of the St. Paul NAACP, and I accepted that role and just recently decided not to, you know, run for re-election. You know, one of the things that I learned is that with all the negativity around Islam and so forth, that people accepted me knowing, you know, that I was a Muslim. And I think to a certain degree that was reassuring to them in some way, shape, or form. You know, I've been able to gain the respect of many people in influential positions, not as a Muslim, but as a, you know, respectable man that happens to be Muslim. And I've never tried to hide or, you know, shy away from my religion. I would wear it as a badge of honor. I know there was a, when I was on the fire department, I used to hear some of these white guys talking, and they said, boy, that Nick, there's just something different about him. He's not like the rest of us. There's just something different about him. You know, I didn't go around. I just, you know, carried myself in a very respectful manner. And a lot of them didn't know I was Muslim. I go to Masjid An-Nur in North Minneapolis, and many of us have been together, including Sister Nisa, since the 70s. And unlike when we started out, it was all black. Now when you walk in our masjid, it looks like the United Nations. I mean, that's the other beautiful thing about Islam. And I'm not saying this to down any other religion or anything, but there used to be a saying in America, and it's still true today, that the most segregated hour is Sunday. And I travel a lot. And it's just a wonderful feeling to go in any masjid without someone, are you new here? Can, you know, can we help you? You know, it's just a welcoming feeling to go anywhere in the world, you know, where there's a masjid, and you know, to feel welcome and loved and respected. Yeah, you know, when I think back to the civil rights struggle and how we were treated and stereotyped, and I mean, we're still going through this to a certain extent, but how now, post 9/11, a lot of the attention has been diverted from us towards Muslims. And where their civil rights and human rights are being violated on a regular basis, and this being the supposedly the example for democracy and freedom and justice for the world, it's taken an ugly turn again. You know, it's unfortunate that we as a country did not learn our lesson from our past, and how we as a country have treated people in the past based on perceptions and stereotyping and innuendos, and just painting everyone of a certain faith, in this case Islam, with the same stroke of the brush. I think one of the biggest problems that Muslims have in Minnesota is misunderstanding on the part of other people. I think if people would just take time to seek out folks that are of the faith, many times they work with individuals that are Muslims and don't even realize it and have a good opinion about them. Unfortunately, their opinion sometimes is swayed or changed when they find out that they are of the faith. And so one of the biggest problems that we have, and it's a, you know, it's always been a problem, was a problem with racism, and that is ignorance. To me, that's something that, you know, Minnesotans don't like to talk about race, nor do they really like to talk about religion, especially as it pertains to Islam. But I think the experience, for the most part, have been good. I don't think we have had some of the same incidents that they've had in other parts of the country, where they don't want you to build a mosque. In Georgia, they don't want to expand a mosque down there, which is just, you know, absolutely ridiculous. We elected the first Muslim congressman in the country, Brother Keith Ellison. And so I think that says a lot for Minnesotans.